Bring her along. He rubs his hands together. Nothing like just you and your girl in front of the big screen. A mischievous laugh jumbles from his mouth now. I used to love bringing the girls here myself when I was a kid. That's why I bought this place when I retired from building. Did you ever make any money out of it? Oh, Christ, no. I don't need it. I just like putting them on, watching them, sleeping a bit. The wife says if it keeps me out of strife, why not? Fair enough. So when you think you'll make it back? Tomorrow, maybe. He gives me a catalogue the size of an encyclopedia to look through and suggest a movie. But I don't need it. No, thanks, I explain to him. I know what I want. Really? Already? I nod. Cool hand, Luke. He rubs his hands together again and grins. Lovely choice. Great film. Paul Newman's outstanding. And George Kennedy, your namesake, unforgettable. 7:30 tomorrow? Beautiful. Great. I'll see you and your girl tomorrow, then. What's her name, this girl of yours? Audrey. Ah, lovely. I'm about to leave when I realize I have no idea of this man's name. He apologizes. Oh, I'm very sorry, Ed. My name's Bernie. Bernie Price. Well, nice to meet you, Bernie. I make my way out. Same here, he says. I'm glad you came. Me too. I step out into the hot air of late afternoon and summer. Christmas Eve's on Thursday this year, which is when everyone's coming over for cards, turkey, and Marv's big kiss with the doorman. I ring Audrey about tomorrow, and she cancels a date with the boyfriend. I think she could tell by the urgency in my voice that I needed her to come out with me. As soon as we've sorted that out, I go for a walk to Miller's place on Harrison Avenue. She opens the door, and it seems frailty has overcome her in the past weeks. It's been a while since I visited, and she glows upon my arrival. She stands crookedly at first, but straightens when she sees my face.
Jimmy!
Her voice soars.
Come in. Come in.
I do as she says, and when I enter the lounge room, I see she's been trying to read Wuthering Heights on her own, but she hasn't made it far.
Oh, yes, she says when she comes in with the tea. I've been trying to read it without you, but it's not quite working.
You want me to read you some now?
That would be nice,
she smiles. I love that old woman's smile. I love the patches of human wrinkles on her face and the joy in her eyes. Would you like to come to my place on Christmas Day? I ask her. She puts the tea down and answers.
Yes, of course, I'd love to.
She lets herself look at me.
It's getting lonelier and lonelier without you, Jimmy.
I know, I say. I know. I put my hand on hers and rub it gently. It's times like this I pray that souls can find each other after death. Miller and the real Jimmy. I pray for that. Chapter 6, I read. Mr. Hindley came home to the funeral, and a thing that amazed us and set the neighbours gossiping right and left, he brought a wife with him. Monday is a full day working in the city. I pick up a lot of people and seem able to weave nicely through the traffic for once. Often my goal as a cab driver is simply not to annoy other drivers. Today, it's working. I'm home just before 6, eat with the doorman, and pick up Audrey around 7. I'm wearing my best jeans, my boots, and an old red shirt that's faded to orange. Audrey answers the door, and I can smell perfume. You smell good, I say.
Well, thank you, kind sir.
And she allows me to kiss her hand. She wears a black skirt, nice tall shoes, and a sandy-colored blouse. It all matches well, and her hair is tied back into a plait with a few strands falling down the side. We walk the street, and she has her arm linked to mine. When we look at ourselves, we laugh. We can't help it. But you smell so good, I tell her again, and you look great.
So do you, she replies, and thinks a moment. Even in that atrocious shirt.
I look down. I know, it's a shocker, isn't it? But Audrey doesn't mind. She almost skips or dances as she walks, and she says,
So what movie are we seeing?
I try to hide my look of self-congratulation, because I know it's a favorite of hers. Cool hand, Luke. She stops, and her expression reaches such a point of beauty that I nearly cry.
You've outdone yourself, Ed.
The last time I heard that phrase was Marv speaking to Margaret, the waitress. This time it isn't sarcastic. Thank you, I reply, and we keep walking. We turn onto Bell Street, and Audrey's arm is still linked with mine. I wish the cinema was further away.
Here they are,
says Bernie Price when we arrive. He's excited. I'm actually surprised he's not asleep. Bernie, I say politely, this is Audrey O'Neill.
The pleasure's mine, Audrey,
Bernie grins. When she goes to the bathroom, he pulls me aside excitedly and whispers,
Well, she's a bit of all right, isn't she, Ed?
She is, I agree. She certainly is. I buy the stale popcorn, or at least try, because Bernie, in his words, won't have it. And we go through and sit down near where I watched from yesterday. He's given us a ticket each. Cool Hand Luke, 7:30 p.m.
Has your call got 3 O's?
Audrey inquires. I look down at it, amused. It has, and it seems perfect for this night. We sit and wait, and soon there's a knocking from above at the projection window. We hear a muffled voice.
You two ready?
Ready, we both call back, and turn again toward the screen. The movie begins. I hope as we watch that Bernie's up there, happy, remembering what it was like when he came here himself at my age. I hope he still believes that Audrey really is my girl as he looks at the two figures sitting in front of the big screen. Just two silhouettes. This message is at the back of me. It's delivered, but I don't see the look on Bernie's face. I try to catch it in the people on the screen. Yes, I hope Bernie's happy. I hope he remembers well. Audrey lightly hums with the music on screen, and at this moment, she's my girl. I can make myself believe it. Tonight's for Bernie, but I also take a small piece of it for myself. We've both seen this movie a few times. It's a definite favorite. We can almost speak the words with the characters in some places, but we never do. We only sit there and enjoy it. We enjoy the empty theater, and I enjoy Audrey. I love the fact that it's only her and me in here alone. Just you and your girl, I hear Bernie say from yesterday, and I realize that Bernie really deserves more than sitting up in the projection room tonight. I whisper to Audrey, Would you mind if I ask Bernie to come down and sit with us? She answers as I expect, Not at all. I climb over her legs and walk out up to the projection room. Bernie's asleep up there, but I wake him gently with my hand. Bernie? I ask.
Oh, yes, Ed?
He pulls himself from his tiredness. Audrey and I say, we were wondering if you'd like to come down and watch the movie with us. He protests, sitting forward.
Oh, no, Ed, I could never do that. Never. I've got a lot to do here, and you young folks should be alone down there.
You know, he says, to get up to some mischief.
Come on, Bernie, I say. We'd love to have you.
No, no, no,
he's adamant.
I can't.
After another minute or so of arguing, I give up and head back down to the cinema. When I sit next to Audrey again, she asks where he is. He didn't want to interrupt us, I tell her, but as I make myself comfortable in my seat, the back door opens and Bernie stands there in the light. He walks slowly down toward us and sits on the other side of Audrey.
Glad you could make it, she whispers.
Bernie looks across at both of us.
Thank you.
His exhausted eyes blink with gratitude, and he faces the screen, alive. Maybe 15 minutes later, Audrey finds my hand on the armrest. She slips her fingers onto mine and takes them. When she softly squeezes me, I look across and discover that she holds Bernie's hand as well. Sometimes Audrey's friendship is enough. Sometimes she knows exactly what to do. Her timing can be perfect. Everything's going fine until the reel needs to be changed. Bernie's asleep again. We wake him.
Bernie, says Audrey quietly.
She shakes him a little. When he wakes up, he jumps from his chair and shouts,
The rail!
He moves quickly toward the aisle, and when I turn to look up at the projection room, I notice. There's already someone in there. Hey, Audrey, I say. Look, and we both stand and fix our eyes on the window. There's someone up in the room. It feels like the air holds its breath around us until I finally get moving. I push past and head for the aisle.
At first, Audrey doesn't know what to do, but soon I hear her feet behind me. I run up the aisle with my eyes gripped to the shadow in the projection room. It sees us, and its movements quicken accordingly. It exits the room almost frantically when we're halfway to the cinema door. Out in the foyer, I can smell tension among the stale popcorn and carpet. The smell of someone been and gone. I head for the staff-only door. Audrey's right behind me. When we get to the room, the first thing I see is Bernie shaking hands. Shock flows down his face, across his lips to his throat. "Bernie?" I ask. "Bernie?"
"He gave me an awful surprise," he says. "Nearly knocked me over as he was running out."
He sits down.
"I'm fine, Ed."
Soon he points over at a pile of reels.
"What?" says Audrey. "What is it?"
"The one on top," Bernie answers. "That isn't one of mine."
He goes over and picks it up. He studies it. There's a small label on it with scuffed lettering. It says one word. Ed.
"Should we put it on?"
I remain still for a while, but answer yes.
"You better get down to the theater," Bernie suggests. "You'll see it much better from there."
Before I go, I ask a question I have a feeling Bernie can answer. "Why, Bernie?" I ask. "Why do they keep doing this to me?" But Bernie only laughs. He says,
"You still don't understand, Ed, do you?"
"Understand what?" He looks up at me and takes his time.
"They do it because they can."
The voice is tired but true, determined.
"It's all been worked out long ago. At least a year."
"Did they tell you that?"
"Yes."
"In those words?"
"Yes."
We stand there a good few minutes, thinking, till Bernie dismisses us.
"Come on," he says. "You kids get back down there. I'll have this reel up and running in a minute."
Back in the foyer, I lean against the door and Audrey speaks.
"Is it always like this?"
"Pretty much," I answer, and she can only shake her head and stay silent. "We better go," I tell her, and after a few attempts, I convince her to go back into the cinema. "It's nearly over," I say, and for some reason I assume Audrey thinks I'm talking about the movie. But me? I don't think about movies anymore. I don't think about anything. Except cards. Except aces. King of Spades, the last reel. The screen is still blank as we walk down the aisle. When it comes alive, the scene is dark and I see the feet of some young men. They're walking. Ahead, they approach a lone figure on the street. It's a street of this town. The figure is also of this town. I stop walking. Immediately. Audrey goes a little further until she turns and sees me with my eyes transfixed on the screen. I only point at first. Then I say, "That's me there, Audrey." On the screen, we watch the footage of the Rose Boys and their friends leaping onto me and mauling me on the street. Standing in the aisle, I feel the scars on my face. My fingers turn and burn on my healing skin. "That's me," I say again. It's a whisper this time, and next to me, Audrey's eyes collapse and cry in the dark, dark theater. The next scene shows me walking out of the library, carrying all those books. After that, it's the lights on Glory Road. It's just a shot of them alone at night, the power and the glory. There's darkness until they flick on and glow through the theater. Next is a scene of the front porch cyclone. Silent. I see my mother delivering her painful words, almost gouging my face with them, until slowly I walk away, nearly right into the camera. We watch me walking toward the Bell Street Cinema. The last thing we see are some words written directly on the reel. They say, "Trying times for Ed Kennedy. Well done, Ed. Time to move on." And it's black again. All black. I still can't move my feet. Audrey attempts to pull me along, but there's almost no point. I stand motionless, staring at the screen. "Let's get to our seats," she says, and I can hear the worry in her voice. "I think you'd better sit down, Ed." Slowly, I lift one foot. then the other.
"Can I play the movie again?"
Bernie calls down. Audrey looks at me with asking eyes. I lift my head slightly and bring it down to agree.
"Yes, Bernie."
To me, she says, "Good idea. It'll take your mind off it." For a few seconds, I consider running back out and searching the whole place for whoever's been here. I want to ask Bernie if it was Daryl and Keith again. I want to know why Bernie's been told what he has and why they keep me in the dark. Yet I know it's futile. They do it because they can. Those words lap me a few times, and I know that this is exactly where I'm supposed to be. For Spades, this is the final trial I need to dig myself out of. We have to stay. When the screen blinks on, I'm awaiting the famous scene in Cool Hand Luke where Luke finally breaks and everyone deserts him. "Where are you now?" I wait for him to scream very soon from his bunk. As we walk back to our seats, Luke begins dragging himself across the screen with complete, desolate desperation. He turns and falls near his bunk. "Where are you now?" he says quietly. "Where are you now?" I ask, and I turn, expecting to see a figure standing somewhere in the theater. I anticipate some footsteps scattering across the floor behind us. I jerk my head around to look. There are people everywhere, but nowhere. In each black space I find, I think I locate someone, but each time, the darkness thickens and that's all there is. Darkness.
"What is it, Ed?"
Audrey asks. "They're here," I answer, although I can't be sure of anything. This whole experience has taught me that. They have to be. But as my eyes scour the whole theater, I see nothing. If they're here, I can't see them. Soon, I realize. I realize when we get back to our seats that they're not here at all now. But they've been. They've been here all right, because sitting on my seat, in my place, is the Ace of Hearts.
"Where are you now?"
screams Luke on the screen, and it's my heartbeat that answers. It shakes the inside of me like the giant clanging of a bell. It swells and ignites as I swallow. I pick the card up and hold it in my hand.
"Hearts," I whisper.
"That's where I am." I'm tempted to read what's on the card, but I manage to watch the rest of the movie just holding it. I watch the movie. I watch Audrey and enjoy the moment, or at least what's left of it. In my hand, I can almost feel the pulse of the heart card as it sits there and waits. Part 4. The Music of Hearts. Ace of Hearts. Making Music. There's music in my head, and it's the color of red and black. It's the morning after. The morning after the Ace of Hearts. I feel it like a hangover. After making sure Bernie was okay, we left him asleep in the projection room. We walked back up onto Bell Street and into the night. It was warm and humid, and the only person around was a young man facing the other way. He was sitting on an old, scabby bench. At first, I was lost in the thoughts of all that had happened, and when I turned around to see him again, he was gone. He'd vanished. Audrey's voice asked a question, but I didn't hear it. It was on the periphery of the wide blast of noise inside my ears. At first, I wondered what it was, but then, without question, I was sure. It was red hearts and black words. Beating. The sound of hearts. Without question, I knew that the young man back there was the one sent to the theater. Maybe he could have led me to the person sending the cards. Maybe many things. As we walked on, the giant noise inside my ears subsided. Footsteps and Audrey's voice became clear again. "Now it's morning, and I hear that sound again. The card is on the floor. The doorman lies next to it. I shut my eyes, but everything's red and black. This is the last card, I tell myself, but I roll over into sleep again, despite the music of hearts beating in my bed. I dream of running. In a car. With the doorman in the front seat. That probably comes from smelling him next to my bed. It's a beautiful dream, like the end of an American movie where the protagonist and his girl drive off into the rest of the world. Except I drive alone. No girl, just me and the doorman. The tragedy is that, as I sleep, I believe it. Waking up is a rude shock because I'm no longer on the open road. Instead, the doorman snoring and his back leg is stretched across the card on the floor. I couldn't get my hands on it now, even if I wanted to. I don't like moving the doorman when he's asleep. In my drawer, the other cards wait now for the last one. Each is complete in its own right. Just one more, I think, and I get to my knees on the bed, burying my head deep in the pillow. I don't pray, but I come close. When I get up, I shift the doorman and read the card again. The black lettering is the same as all the other words I've been given. This time, they say the following titles. The Suitcase, Cat Ballou, Roman Holiday. I'm quite confident that they're all movie titles, though I haven't seen any of them. I recall that The Suitcase was a fairly recent one. It wouldn't have been on at the Bell Street Cinema, but I'm sure it got a run at one of those obscure yet popular theaters in the city. I remember seeing some poster ads. It was a Spanish remake, I think, a comedy gangster movie full of hitmen, bullets, and a suitcase full of stolen Swiss francs. The other two films are unknown to me, but I'm sure I know the man who can help. I'm ready to begin, but in the few days leading up to Christmas, I allow work to get in the way. It's always busy around this time, so I take on some extra shifts and drive a lot of nights. I keep the Ace of Hearts in my shirt pocket. It travels with me wherever I go, and I won't let go of it until this is finished. But will it end with this? I ask myself. Will it let go of me? Already, I know that all of this will stay with me forever. It'll haunt me, but I also fear it will make me feel grateful. I say fear because at times I really don't want this to be a fond memory until it's over. I also fear that nothing really ends at the end. Things just keep going as long as memory can wield its axe, always finding a soft part in your mind to cut through and enter. For the first time in years, I give out Christmas cards. The only difference is that I don't give out cards with little Santas or Christmas trees on them. I find a few old packs of playing cards and pull out all the aces. I write a short note on the card for each place I visited, stick it in a small envelope, and write, "Merry Christmas from Ed." Even for the Rose Boys. It's before a night shift that I drive around and deliver them, and at most places, I escape unnoticed. It's at Sophie's that I'm seen, and I must confess, I kind of wanted her to find me. For some reason, there's something special in me for Sophie. Maybe a part of me loves her because she's the eternal also-ran, a lot like me. But I also know it's more than that. She's beautiful, in the way she is. When I put the envelope in her letterbox, I turn and walk purposefully away, just like everywhere else. But her voice finds me from up above, at her window. "Ed?" she calls down. When I turn back around, she calls again for me to wait, and she's soon out the front door. She wears a white t-shirt and a pair of small blue running shorts. Her hair's tied back, but her fringe floats to her face. "Just brought you a card," I say. "For Christmas." A sudden stupidity overcomes me, and I feel awkward standing there in her driveway. She opens the envelope and reads the card. On hers, I wrote something extra below the diamond. "You've got beauty," I wrote, and I see her eyes melt a little as she reads it. It's what I said to her on the day of the bare feet and the blood at the athletic field. "Thank you, Ed," she says, and she looks intently at the card. "I've never been given a card like this before." "They're all out of Santas and Christmas trees," I answer. It feels strange delivering the cards to these people. They'll never really know what it means, and in some cases, will have no idea who in the hell this Ed person is. In the end, I decide it doesn't matter, and Sophie and I say our goodbyes. "Ed?" she asks. I'm in the cab now and wind down the window. "Sophie? Could you?" Her voice steps politely from her mouth. "Could you tell me what I can give to you? You've given me so much." "I've given you nothing," I tell her. But she knows me well enough. Nothing was an empty shoebox, but we'd never trade it. We both know. The steering wheel's warm as I drive off. The last card I deliver is to Father O'Reilly, who seems to be having a party at his place for all the hopeless cases on his street. Those guys who tried to get my jacket and my non-existent money and cigarettes are there, all eating sausage sandwiches with lots of sauce and onions.
Hey, look!
One points me out. I think it's Joe.
It's Ed!
He tries to find the father.
Hey, father!
He calls, spitting out half his sandwich with the words.
Ed's here!
Father O'Reilly comes hurrying over and says,
And here he is, the man who made all the difference to the year. I've been trying to call you.
I've been a bit busy, father.
Ah, yes, he nods. Your mission.
He pulls me aside and says, Look, I just want to thank you again, Ed. I know I should feel good about that, but I don't. I'm not here to be thanked, father. I was just bringing you a lousy Christmas card.
Well, I thank you anyway, boy.
I'm frustrated because of my final ace. Hearts, of all things to be last. I expected spades. I got hearts, and for some reason, this feels the most dangerous of them all. People die of broken hearts. They have heart attacks, and it's the heart that hurts most when things go wrong and fall apart. When I walk back onto the street, the father intuits my apprehension. He says,
Still not over, is it?
He knows he was just one piece of what I have to do, one message of the given hand.
No, father, I reply. It's not over. You'll be all right,
he says to me. No, I tell him. I won't. I won't be okay just for the sake of it. Not anymore.
It's true. If I'm ever going to be okay, I'll have to earn it.
The card still sits in my pocket as I wish the father a Merry Christmas and move on into the evening. I feel the Ace of Hearts sway inside my pocket. It leans forward, trying to get closer to the air and the world I have to face. Where to? I ask my first pickup the next day, but I can't hear the answer. All I can hear is the sound of the hearts again, shouting and screaming and beating through my ears. Faster, faster. There is no engine. There's no tick-tock of the blinker, no voice of the customer, and no sizzle of the traffic. Only hearts. In my pocket, in my ears, in my pants, on my skin, on my breath. They're in the inside of me. Just hearts, I say, everywhere. But my customer has no idea what I'm talking about.
Here'll do, she says.
She's about 40. And wears deodorant that smells like sweet smoke, and makeup the color of roses. When she hands me the money, she speaks, looking at me in the mirror.
Merry Christmas, she says. Her voice sounds like hearts.
Two of hearts. The kiss. The grave. The fire. I've bought everything I need to buy. More alcohol than food, of course. And by the time everyone shows up for Christmas Eve, my shack smells like turkey, coleslaw, and, of course, the doorman. For a while, the turkey overpowers him, but the smell of that dog can get to anything. First to show up is Audrey. She brings a bottle and some biscuits she's made.
Sorry, Ed, she tells me as she comes in. I can't stay too long. She kisses me on the cheek. Simon's got this thing on with his mates, and he wants me to go.
Do you want to go? I ask, though I know she does. Why would you prefer to stay with three positively pointless blokes and a filthy dog? She'd be crazy to stay with us. Audrey answers,
Of course. You know I wouldn't do anything I don't want to.
That's true, I reply. It is. We start to drink as Richie comes in next. We hear his bike from the top of the street, and when he pulls in, he calls out for us to open the door for him. He carries in a big cooler stocked with prawns, salmon, and sliced lemons.
Not bad, huh?
He drops it.
The least I could do.
How'd you get it here? I ask.
What?
The cooler, you know, with the bike.
Oh, I strapped it on back. I was practically standing up the whole way. The cooler took up half my seat.
Richie winks at us, generously.
It was worth it, though.
Half his doll check would have gone into the contents of that cooler. Now, we wait. For Marv.
I bet he doesn't show up,
Richie says once he's settled in. His hand feels at the scratchy whiskers on his face, and his muddy hair is as unwashed and coarse as ever. Amusement is his overriding expression. He's looking forward to this. Sipping a beer and sitting on the couch, he uses the doorman as a footstool. He's lazy and lanky, Richie, lying there with his feet extended in comfort. Somehow, he looks gracious.
Oh, he's showing up all right, I affirm. If he doesn't, I'll drag the doorman to his doorstep and make him kiss him right there and then.
I put down my drink. I haven't looked forward to Christmas like this for years.
Me too, Richie replies. He can barely wait.
Plus, it's a free feed, I continue. Marv might have 40 grand in the bank, but he still can't keep himself from freeloading. Believe me, he'll come.
The tight ass, Richie affirms.
This is Christmas spirit in its purest form.
Should we call him? Audrey suggests.
No, let him come to us, Richie says with a smirk, and I can smell it. This is going to be great.
He looks down at the dog and says,
You all pumped up for the big one, doorman?
The doorman looks up as if to say,
Just what the hell are you on about, mate?
No one's told him about what's still to come tonight. The poor dog. Nobody asked him if it was okay. Finally, Marv walks in, empty-handed.
Merry Christmas, he says.
Yeah, I say. Same to you.
I point now to his empty hands. Geez, you're a generous bastard, aren't you? But I know how Marv thinks. He's decided that if he has to kiss the doorman, that's more than enough for him to do this year. I can also tell he's still clinging to a faint hope that we all might have forgotten. Richie destroys all notions of that immediately. He stands up and says,
Well, Marv?
He's grinning.
Well, what?
You know, Audrey chimes in.
No, Marv persists.
I don't.
Now, don't you give me the shits, Richie lays down the law. You know it, we know it.
He's enjoying this. I almost expect him to rub his hands together with delight.
Marv, he announces, you will kiss this dog.
He motions to the doorman.
And when you kiss him, you're going to like it. You're going to do it with a big bloody smile on your face, or else we'll make you do it again and again and...
All right,
Marv snarls. He reminds me of a little kid not getting his own way.
On top of the head, right?
Oh, no,
Richie asserts. He stands up, relishing every minute of this.
I believe the agreement was that you'd kiss him right on the lips. And that's just,
he points his finger at Marv, where you're going to do it. The doorman looks up. He looks uneasy as we all watch him.
You poor fella, Richie states.
Marv sulks.
Oh no.
Not you, Richie charges. Him.
And he throws his head toward the dog.
All right,
Audrey says.
No messing about now.
She hands me my camera.
Off you go, Marv. He's all yours.
With the weight of the world on his shoulders, Marv bends down in horror and finally brings himself to get close to the doorman's face. The doorman looks nervous enough to cry. Black and gold fur and watery eyes.
Does he have to have his tongue out like that?
Marv asks me. He's a dog, I say. What more do you want from him? Copiously disgruntled, Marv eventually does it. He leans in and kisses the doorman on the snout, just long enough for me to take the photo and for Audrey and Richie to cheer, clap, and crack up.
Ha ha! That wasn't so hard now, was it?
Richie says, but Marv's gone straight to the bathroom. The poor doorman. I give him a kiss myself, on the forehead, and a prime piece of turkey.
Thanks, Ed.
He smiles. The doorman's got a nice smile. We manage to get Marv to loosen up and laugh a bit later, though he still complains of tasting the doorman on his lips. We all eat and drink and play some cards until a knock at the door brings the boyfriend in. He drinks with us a while and eats some prawns. He's a nice guy, I decide, but I can tell by looking. Audrey doesn't love him. I guess that's the point. After Audrey's gone, we decide not to cry in our beer. Richie, Marv and I eat up, drink up, and go wandering through town. There's a bonfire lighting up the top of Main Street, and that's the way we head. For a while, it's hard to walk straight, but by the time we make it, we're all pretty sober. It's a good night. People dancing, loud talking, a few people fighting. It's always the way at Christmas. The whole year's tension comes to a head. At the fire, I see Angie Caruso and her kids. Or rather, they come over to me. There's a tap on my leg, and when I look down, I see one of her boys, the one that always cries.
"Hey, mister," he says.
When I turn around, I see Angie Caruso holding an ice cream. She offers it to me and says,
"Merry Christmas, Ed."
I take it. "Thanks," I say. "Just what I needed."
"Sometimes we all do."
Her happiness at being able to return a small favor is obvious. I take a bite and ask, "So how are you, Angie?" She looks at the kids and now back at me.
"I'm surviving, Ed. Sometimes that's enough."
She recalls something.
"Thanks for the card, by the way."
Slowly, Angie begins to move on. "No worries," I call after her. "Enjoy the night."
"Enjoy the ice cream," she answers.
She walks alongside the fire.
"What was that all about?" asks Marv.
"Just a girl I know. I've never been given an ice cream for Christmas before." Watching the fire, I let the sweet cool of it soak into my lips. Behind me, I hear a father talking to his son.
"Do that again," he says, "and I'll kick your ass so hard you'll fall into the fire." His voice sweetens sardonically. "And we wouldn't want that now, would we? Santa won't be too impressed with that, will he now?" "No, he won't."
Marv, Richie and I all enjoy hearing that.
"Ah," Richie sighs happily. "This is what Christmas is all about."
We've all heard that from our fathers, at least once. I think of my own father, dead and buried. My first Christmas without him.
"Merry Christmas, Dad," I say, and I make sure to keep my eyes out of the fire.
The ice cream melts to my fingers. As the night moves on and blurs toward Christmas morning, Marv, Richie and I become separated. The crowd's thick, and once we lose each other, it's all over. I go back through town and visit my father's grave and stay there a long time. From the cemetery, I see a small glow that's the fire, and I sit there, looking at the gravestone with my father's name on it. I cried at his funeral. I let the tears trample my face in complete silence, guilty that I couldn't even summon the courage to speak about him. I knew everyone there was only thinking about what a drunk he was, while I was remembering the other things as well.
"He was a gentleman," I whisper now. If only I could have said that on the day, I think, because my father never had a bad word for anybody, or a true act of unkindness.
Certainly, he never achieved much, and he disappointed my mother with broken promises, but I don't think he deserved not a word from anyone in his family that day.
"I'm sorry," I tell him now as I get up to leave. "I'm so sorry, Dad." I walk away, afraid.
Afraid because I don't want my own funeral to be that forlorn and empty. I want words at my funeral. But I guess that means you need life in your life. Walking now. Just walking. When I make it home, I find Marv asleep in the back seat of his car and Richie sitting on my porch. His legs are out straight and he leans back against the fibro. On closer inspection, I find that Richie's also asleep. I tug at his sleeve.
"Richie," I whisper, "wake up."
His eyes slap open.
"What?"
he says, almost in panic.
"What?"
"You're asleep on my porch," I tell him. "You better get home." He shakes himself awake now, looks at the half moon, and says,
"I left my keys on your kitchen table."
"Come on." I drop my hand, he takes it, and I help him up. Inside, I find it's a few minutes past 3 o'clock. Richie's fingers curl around the keys.
"You want anything?" I ask. "Drink? Food? Coffee?"
"Nah, thanks." But he doesn't leave either. For a moment, we stand awkwardly, until finally Richie looks just past me and says,
"I don't feel like going home tonight, Ed."
I catch a dent of sadness in his eyes, but it disappears immediately as Richie quickly smooths it over.
He only looks at the keys now, and I wonder what lurks beneath the cool, calm exterior of my friend. I wonder tiredly what could ever bother someone as laid back as Richie. His eyes drag themselves up again to mine. Sure, I tell him. Stay here the night. Richie sits down at the table. Thanks, Ed, he says. Hey, doorman. The doorman has walked into the kitchen as I go out to get Marv. For a moment, I consider leaving him out in the car, but Christmas spirit can even make its way to someone like me. I attempt to knock on the window, but my hand goes right through. Of course, there is no window. Marv still hasn't had it fixed since the bungled bank robbery. I think he got a quote for it, but the guy said the window would end up being worth more than the car. He sleeps with his head twisted in his hands, and the mosquitoes are queuing up for his blood. The front door's unlocked, so I open it and matter-of-factly blow the horn.
Christ!
Marv shrieks. Come inside, I tell him. Soon after, I hear the car door open and slam, and the scuffing of his feet behind me. Richie gets the couch, Marv takes my bed, and I decide to stay in the kitchen. I tell Marv I wouldn't have slept anyway, and he's quite gracious in accepting the bed.
Thanks, Ed.
Before he goes in, I take my opportunity, walk inside the room, and retrieve all the cards from the drawer next to the bed. The Tatupu stone is also there. In the kitchen, I go through them, reading them all again, though the fatigue in my eyes makes the words swap and turn and juggle. I feel eroded. In moments of awakeness, I remember the diamonds, relive the clubs, and even smile about the spades. I worry about the hearts. I don't want to sleep in case I dream them. Three of Hearts, The Casual Suit. Tradition can be a dirty word, especially around Christmas. Families all over the globe get together and enjoy each other's company. For all of a few minutes. For an hour, they endure each other. After that, they just manage to stomach each other. I go over to Marv's place after an uneventful morning with Richie and Marv. All we did was eat leftovers from the night before and play a few games of annoyance. It wasn't the same without Audrey, and it didn't take long for us to pack up and for the other two to leave. The usual agreement with my family is for a 12 o'clock meeting time at Marv's place. My sisters are there with their kids and husbands, and Tommy's shown up with a stunning girl he's managed to pick up at university. This is Ingrid, he introduces her, and I must say, Ingrid is calendar-worthy. She has long brown hair, a lovely tan face, and a body I'd let myself dissolve in. Nice to meet you, she says. Lovely voice, too. I've heard a lot about you, Ed. She's lying, of course, and I decide not to go along with it. This year I simply don't have the strength. I say, no, you haven't, Ingrid, but I remain pleasant as I say it. I'm almost shy. She's too beautiful to get annoyed with. Beautiful girls get away with murder.
Oh, you're here, says Ma when she sees me.
Merry Christmas, Ma, I shout excitedly, and I'm sure everyone picks up on the sarcasm in my voice. We eat. We give presents. I give Lee's and Catherine's kids 100 airplane rides and piggybacks, or at least until I can't stand up anymore. I also catch Tommy with his hands all over Ingrid in the lounge room, right near the famous cedar coffee table. Shit, sorry, and I back away from the room. Good luck to him. By 4:15, it's time to go and pick up Mella. I kiss my sisters, shake the hands of my brothers-in-law, and say a final goodbye to the kids.
Last to get here, first to leave, says Ma, blowing out some cigarette smoke.
She smokes a lot at Christmas.
And he lives the closest, which nearly makes me throw my temper from my skin and hurl it at her.
Cheating on Dad, I think. Insulting me at every turn. I want so much to verbally abuse this woman standing there in the kitchen, sucking in smoke and pouring it out from her lungs. Instead, I look right at her. I speak through the warm mist. The smoking makes you ugly, I say, and I walk out, leaving her stranded among the haze. On the front lawn as I leave, I'm called back twice. First by Tommy, then Ma. Tommy comes out and says,
You doing all right, Ed?
I walk back. I'm doing fine, Tommy. It's been a crazy year, but I'm doing fine. You? We sit on the front steps,
which are half in shadow, half in the sun. As it happens, I sit in the darkness and Tommy sits in the light. Quite symbolic, really. It's the first time I felt comfortable all day, as my brother and I talk and answer each other's brief questions.
University okay?
Yeah, the marks have been good. Better than I hoped.
And Ingrid?
There's a silence before we can't contain it anymore. It breaks between us and we both laugh. It feels very boyish, but I'm congratulating him, and Tommy's congratulating himself.
She's not bad, he says,
and genuinely I tell my brother that I'm proud of him, and not for Ingrid. Ingrid means nothing in comparison to what I'm talking about. I say, good for you, Tommy. Plant my hand on his back and stand up. Good luck. As I walk down the steps, he says, I'll call you sometime. We'll get together. But again, I can't go along with it. I turn and speak with a quietness that surprises even me. I say, I doubt you will, Tommy. And it feels good. It feels nice to emerge from the lies. Tommy agrees. He says, you're right, Ed. We're still brothers, and who knows? Maybe one day. One day, I feel certain, we'll get together and remember and tell and speak many things. Things bigger than university and Ingrid. Just not soon. For now, I walk across the lawn and say, bye, Tommy. Thanks for coming out. And I'm satisfied with just one thing. I'd wanted to stay on that porch with him until the sun shone bright on both of us, but I didn't. I stood up and walked down the steps. I'd rather chase the sun than wait for it. As Tommy goes in and I leave again, Ma comes out.
Ed,
she calls. I face her. She walks closer and says, Merry Christmas, all right? Same to you. Then I add, it's the person, Ma, not the place. If you left here, you'd have been the same anywhere else. It's truth enough, but I can't stop now. If I ever leave this place, I swallow, I'll make sure I'm better here first.
Okay, Ed.
She's stunned, and I feel sorry for the woman standing on the front porch of a poor street in an ordinary town.
That sounds fair.
See you later, Ma. I'm gone. That had to be done. I drop in at home for a quick drink and go to Miller's. When I get there, she's waiting eagerly, wearing a light blue summer dress and holding a present. She also holds an excitement across her face.
For you, Jimmy,
she says, handing me the big flat box. I feel bad because I don't have a gift for her. I'm sorry, I begin to say, but she shuts me up quickly with a wave of her hand.
It's enough that you came back for me, she says. Are you going to open it?
No, I'll wait. And I offer the old lady my arm. She takes it and we leave her house, heading over to my place. I ask if we should get a cab, but she's happy to walk. And halfway there, I'm not sure if she's going to make it. She coughs hard and struggles for air. I imagine myself having to carry her. She makes it, though, and I give her some wine when we get there.
Thank you, Jimmy,
she says, but she sinks into the armchair and falls asleep almost straight away. As she remains there, I come back a few times to check she's still alive, but I can always hear her breathing. In the end, I sit in the lounge room with her as the day dies outside the window. When she wakes up, we eat turkey from last night and some bean salad.
Marvelous, Jimmy, the old lady beams. Just marvelous.
Her smile crackles. In normal circumstances, I prefer to shoot someone who uses the word marvelous, but it suits Miller down to the ground. She wipes her mouth and mutters marvelous several times, and I feel like Christmas is complete.
Now,
she slaps the arms of the chair. She seems much more alive now that she slept a little.
Will you open your present, Jimmy?
I give in. Of course. I go over to the gift wrap box and lift the lid. Inside is a casual black suit and an ocean blue shirt. It's probably the first and last suit anyone will ever buy me.
You like?
She asks. It's great. I fall in love with it instantly, despite knowing I'll rarely, if ever, get a chance to wear it.
Put it on, Jimmy.
I'm going, I say, I'm going. And once I've disappeared to the bedroom to put it on, I find an old pair of black shoes to match. The suit doesn't have big shoulders, which is a relief. I'm excited to get back out there to show her, but when I come out, Miller's asleep again. So I sit, in the suit.
When she wakes up, the old lady says,
"Oh, that's a nice suit, Jimmy."
She even touches it to feel the fabric.
"Where'd you get it from?"
I stand a moment, confused, before realizing that she's completely forgotten. I give the old lady a kiss on the cheek. "A beautiful woman gave it to me," I say. "The old lady's marvelous."
"That's lovely,"
she says. "It is," I agree. She's right. After we've had coffee, I call a cab and go home with her. The driver's actually Simon, the boyfriend, earning some double time on Christmas Day. Before I take Miller inside, I ask him to wait. It's laziness, I know, but I've got the money today and can afford the trip home.
"Well, thanks again, Jimmy,"
Miller says, and she walks shakily to the kitchen. She's so frail, yet so beautiful.
"It's been a great day,"
she tells me, and I can't help but agree. It has. It hits me that all along I thought I was doing this old lady a favor by spending Christmas Day with her. Walking out again in my casual black suit, I realize it's the opposite. I'm the privileged one, and the old lady will always be marvelous. "Back home?" the boyfriend asks me when I return to the cab. "Yes, please." I sit in the front seat, and the boyfriend initiates conversation. He seems intent on discussing Audrey, though I wish he wouldn't. He says, "So, you and Audrey been friends for years, huh?" I look at the dash. "Probably more than years." He comes at me. "Do you love her?" I'm taken aback by the frankness of his question, especially so early in the dialogue. I come to the conclusion that he knows it's only a short drive. He wants to maximize outcomes quickly, which is fair enough. He asks again. "Well?"
"Well what?"
"Now don't start on me, Kennedy. Do you love her or not?"
"Well, what do you think?"
He rubs his chin and says nothing, so I continue. I say, "Whether I love her isn't the question at all. Whether she loves you is what you want to know." My voice trounces him. I'm all over the poor guy, isn't it?
"Well..."
He trips about as he drives, and I see he deserves at least some form of an answer. "She doesn't want to love you," I tell him. "She doesn't want to love anyone. She's had a rough life, Audrey. The only people she ever loved, she hated." I get some flashbacks of when we were growing up. She was hurt a lot, and she vowed it wouldn't continue that way. She wouldn't let it. The boyfriend says nothing. "He's handsome," I decide. "More handsome than me. He has soft eyes and a solid jaw. The whiskers on his face give him that male model look." We're silent till we pull up back at my place, and the boyfriend speaks again. He says,
"She loves you, Ed."
I look at him. "But she wants you. And that's the problem." "Here." I pass him the money, but he waves it away. "On the house," he says, but I try again, and this time he takes it. "Don't put it in the till," I suggest. "I think you've earned it for your own pocket today." We share a moment before I get out. "Nice talking to you," I say, and we shake hands. "Merry Christmas to you, Simon." I guess he's Simon now, not the boyfriend. Once inside, I sleep on the couch in my casual black suit and the ocean blue shirt. Merry Christmas, Ed. Four of Hearts, to feel the fear. I work on Boxing Day and visit Bernie at the Bell Street Cinema the next day.
"Ed Kennedy,"
he cries out when I get there.
"Back for more, eh?"
"No," I tell him. "I need your help, Bernie." Immediately he comes closer and asks,
"What can I do for you?"
"Well, you know your movies, right?"
"Of course. You can watch anything you..."
"Shh. Just tell me, Bernie. Tell me everything you know about these titles." I pull out the Ace of Hearts, although I could easily recite them without it. The Suitcase, Cat Ballou, and Roman Holiday. Bernie clicks into business straight away.
"Roman Holiday I have, but the other two I don't."
He inundates me with facts.
"Roman Holiday is widely considered one of the best movies starring Gregory Peck, made in 1953 and directed by William Wyler of Ben-Hur fame. It was filmed with breathtaking beauty in Rome and was famous for the glorious performance of Audrey Hepburn, who Peck insisted have equal billing. He claimed that if she didn't, he would be a laughingstock.
Such was the strength of her performance. This was backed up when she pocketed an Oscar for her troubles.
He talks on at a very fast pace, but I rewind to one word that Bernie has spoken. Audrey, I think. Audrey, I say.
Yes.
He looks at me, disoriented by my ignorance.
Yes, Audrey Hepburn. And she was absolutely marv...
No, don't say marvellous, I beg. That word belongs to Miller.
Audrey Hepburn,
I almost shout. What can you tell me about the other two?
Well, I've got a catalogue, Bernie explains. It's even bigger than the one I showed you last time. It contains just about every movie ever released. Actors, directors, cinematographers, soundtracks, musical scores, the lot.
He brings back the thick book and offers it to me. First up, Cat Ballou. I read aloud as soon as I find the page. Starring Lee Marvin in one of his most famous roles. I stop because I found it. I go back and read the name again. Lee Marvin. Now I move on to the suitcase. As soon as I find it, I read the cast list and the director. The director of the suitcase is someone called Pablo Sanchez. He and Richie share the same last name. And I have my three addresses. Richie, Marv, Audrey. There's an express exhilaration that is quickly replaced by anxiety. I hope the messages are good, I think, but something tells me this won't be easy. There must be good reason these three were left till last. As well as being my friends, they'll also be the most challenging messages I have to deliver. I can feel it. I hold the card and drop the catalogue book to the counter. Bernie's concerned.
What is it, Ed?
I look at him and say, wish me luck, Bernie. Wish me the heart to get through this. He does. Still holding the card, I walk out onto the street. Outside, I meet the darkness and uncertainty of what will come next. I feel the fear, but I walk fast toward it. The smell of street struggles to get its hands on me, but I shrug it off and walk on. Each time a shudder makes its way to my arms and legs, I walk harder, deciding if Audrey needs me, and Richie and Marv, I have to hurry. Fear is the street. Fear is every step. The darkness grows heavier on the road, and I begin to run. My first instinct tells me to go straight to Audrey's. I want to make it there as fast as possible to ease whatever problem she has. I don't even dare to contemplate the fact that I might need to perform something unpleasant. Just get there, I tell myself, but then it's another instinct that takes control. I walk on but pull the card up and hold it in front of my eyes. I check the order. Richie, Marv, Audrey. A strong feeling reaches out in front of me and drags with it a knowledge that I have to go in order. Audrey's last for a reason, and I know it. First up's Richie. Yes, I agree with my thoughts, and I keep walking hard. I make my way to Richie's place on Bridge Street. I work out the quickest way there, and my feet move further and faster. Am I hurrying so I can make it quicker to Audrey? I ask, but I give no answer. I focus on Richie. A vision of his face comes to me as I pass under the branches of a tree. I brush through the leaves and wipe him from my sight, hearing his voice and the constant remarks during cards. I remember his Christmas joy at Marv's kiss with the doorman. Richie, I wonder. What message do I deliver to Richie? I'm nearly there now. The corner of Bridge Street is up ahead. My pulse goes into spasm and gains momentum. As I round the bend, I see Richie's place immediately. A question of shock stands beside me and breathes at my face. I see the lights in Richie's kitchen and in the lounge room, but my path is distracted by one thought. It refuses to leave. What do I do now? It asks me. Every other place was relatively easy because I didn't really know the people, excluding Ma. And when I was sitting in that Italian restaurant, I had no idea I was waiting for her. So there wasn't much choice. I just waited for the opportunity to arise. But with Richie, Marv, and Audrey, I know them all far too well to loiter around their houses. It's the last thing I would ever do. Still, I weigh it up for close to a minute and eventually decide to cross the road and sit against an old oak tree to wait. I'm there nearly an hour, and to be perfectly honest, not a whole lot's happening. I notice that Richie's folks are home from their holiday. I saw his ma doing the dishes. It's getting late, and soon it's only the kitchen that's lit up. House lights across the whole street are being cut down at the knees, and all that's left are the street lights.